The evening's program began with a performance by Mrs. Mehta of some traditional East Indian music. Mr. Mehta followed with his talk on yoga.
Generally, before I give my music, I introduce the instrument which I use. This instrument is tambura, T-A-M-B-U-R-A. It is not sitar nor guitar, obviously. This instrument is a very important instrument for Indian classical music, because for Indian classical music, this instrument provides a foundational note, the basic note, the pitch on which the musician builds his or her entire music. And therefore, this is a very, very important instrument for classical musician. I do not wish to speak more about the instrument nor about Indian music, because our subject is quite different tonight. My music will consist of in two parts. First of all, I shall sing or recite verses from the Upanishad, then a song, once again a verse, and then a song. The two verses from the Upanishad are from the Kathopanishad, Katha Upanishad. The main theme of those two verses is that there is but one reality. It expresses itself in many, many forms. And the person who is able to realize, experience that one reality within his heart, he attains to supreme bliss, to supreme joy. Then the second verse says that the world, the universe, whatever happens is fleeting. It is going away, it is moving. But in the midst of movement, in the midst of fleeting nature of reality, of universe, there is something which is eternal. There is something which is not moving at all. And person who is able to realize this, something which is unmoving, which is eternal, which is ever steady, that person attains to supreme peace, supreme joy, supreme bliss, or supreme peace. That is the path of self-realization. This will be followed by a song, and the main theme of the song is once again the same. The reality is in the heart. Why do you go in search of that reality outside? It is not in the temple, it is not in the church, it is neither in the ceremonial nor in the outer observances of formal religion. But if you know how to seek it, how to search for it in the right direction, then you can find it in a moment, not in a long time, but in a moment you can realize that reality. This is really the path of knowledge, what in India, what is called Jnana Marga, yoga through knowledge. But the second song will be a realization through love or through devotion. The first song is by the great Indian mystic Kabir, who lived about 500 years ago. The second song is by a woman mystic, Meera Bai. She was a royal princess, but she chose the path of devotion, the path of love. And in this particular song she says, I have seen with my own eyes God, my beloved, Lord Krishna. He is beauty personified. He is sweetness personified. And I see him with a flute, playing on the flute, dancing, and completely happy and joyous. That is how she describes her beloved. So the one song is the songs given by a person who has realized through the path of knowledge. The second song is devotee who has realized through the path of love and devotion.
Friends, the subject of this evening's discussion, as you know, is yoga and the path of self-realization. We shall presently explore the subject of yoga, but the most intriguing term in this title is self-realization, the path of self-realization. Have we to discover a path of self-realization? Don't we know ourselves? If we do not know ourselves, then what are we? Who are we? Are we functioning under a mistaken identity? If so, how has this mistaken identity come about? These are some of the subjects that we must explore as we try to understand yoga and self-realization. Yoga, as you know, it is a known fact now in the Western world also, that yoga means union. It speaks about union. The very word yoga is union. But the question arises, union with what? Immediately we will say, union with God, union with the divine, union with the ultimate reality, or in the Hindu context we will say, union with the Brahman. But then Hindu philosophy particularly has very boldly stated, and stated with the greatest emphasis, that the nature of ultimate reality and the nature of man are not different. Particularly the philosophy of the Upanishad says that the nature of the Brahman resides in the Atman, which means the nature of the universal spirit resides in the individual soul. If that be the case, then we have to explore ourselves in order to understand the nature of reality. We do not have to go anywhere else, because reality is not lying somewhere outside us. Not merely outside us, it is outside, but it is fundamentally inside. And therefore the exploration of our true identity, if there is a mistaken identity, then the search for true identity has to be made within ourselves. And that is the purpose of yoga. As I'm sure you are familiar with the yoga aphorisms of Patanjali, because it is a veritable textbook on yoga, and it discusses all aspects of yoga. But the very first definition of yoga that Patanjali has given in his yoga aphorisms is that yoga is that state of consciousness from where all centers of reaction have been eliminated. It is a state of consciousness. In fact, from one standpoint, one might say that yoga is a reversal of consciousness. This was given expression to by Madame Blavatsky, the founder of the Theosophical Society, in her priceless book, The Voice of the Silence, where she says, the rose must re-become the bud. And commenting upon that statement, she says that the pupil must regain the child state that he has lost. This is what is meant by the reversal of consciousness. In our consciousness, modified as it has been, and due to that modification, there are numerous centers of reaction. The consciousness has become corrupted. It is no longer the innocent consciousness that it was. In fact, our consciousness has become opaque, and therefore it does not allow light to pass through. To transform the opaque consciousness into a transparent consciousness, that is the purpose of yoga. That is what Patanjali says by saying that the consciousness must be completely free from all modifications, all centers of reaction. So the passage of time, as we live our lives, our consciousness gets modified so that it does not have the original innocence, but it gets constantly modified. And what is it that modifies this consciousness? It is this which needs to be understood. We very often say in the English language that habit is our second nature. If habit is the second nature, what is the first nature? We do not know what the first nature is, because habit has modified our consciousness. And all our perceptions are through the modified consciousness. As you know, modern physics today is discussing the subject of perception. In fact, the author of the Tao of Physics, Capra, in his second book, The Turning Point, says at one place that we are in the midst of a crisis. And he says it is a crisis of perception. It is a crisis of perception because modern science cannot tell us what matter is. It is unable to tell us what is. Because they say there is the phenomena that is functioning, which can be described as the observer-observed phenomena. They say that in every act of observation, the observer is involved. In every act of perception, the perceiver is involved. And therefore, the perceiver modifies the object of perception. And therefore, what we see is something that has been already modified. We do not see what is. This modification has been brought about, and it is the consciousness that has modified, is a consciousness that is no longer pure and innocent, but it is a modified, it is a corrupted consciousness. Modern science tells us that consciousness is the basic stuff. This universe, this physical universe, does not rest on matter. It rests on consciousness. Then what is this consciousness? Physics is unable to throw much light on this subject of consciousness. It is only as we turn to yoga that we are enabled to understand what consciousness is, how it functions, how it gets corrupted, how it is modified. All these we are able to understand through yoga, because yoga is science of consciousness. We are familiar with the science of matter, but the science of matter has brought us to a deadlock, because matter is not the basic stuff, that is what science says. And therefore, we are on the doorstep of consciousness. But as I said, the science of matter is unable to throw any light on the science of consciousness. We have to go to the science of consciousness And the science of consciousness is yoga, and yoga in its proper perspective. And therefore, Patanjali says that the consciousness gets modified. And to stop these modifications, to stop these corruptions that are taking place in consciousness, to see that the opaqueness that is brought about in consciousness is brought to a cessation, this is what is required by true yoga. In other words, our consciousness is modified, and therefore we do not know who we are. We know only by the modification that has taken place. And therefore we have a mistaken identity, in the sense that we have identified ourselves something which we are not, because our consciousness, conditioned and corrupt as it is unable to give us the correct perception of what is, because of which we find that there has taken place a false identification. If you go to the whole theory of knowledge, you will find that knowledge is of various categories. The first category of knowledge is knowledge by ignorance. Ignorance is also one category of knowledge. In fact, this is what is discussed in certain systems of Hindu philosophy, that ignorance, if I am ignorant of something, that also is a knowledge. That is the first category of knowledge. Then we move to the second category of knowledge, and the second category of knowledge is knowledge by ideation. We have ideas about things. Idea about soul, idea about God, idea about spirituality. Our consciousness is filled with these ideas. And by and large, what we call knowledge is only knowledge by ideation. Then we come to the third category of knowledge. And the third category of knowledge is knowledge by identification. We get ourselves identified something. An idea persists. An idea is transformed sometimes into an ideal, and then we are identified with it. This is the third category of knowledge, knowledge by identification. And the fourth category of knowledge is knowledge by identity. We become the very subject that we want to know. The subject becomes the object. The knower becomes the known. This is what is known as knowledge by identity. And you will find in the yoga systems all these categories of knowledge discussed. But we will not go into all that. We are concerned with this mistaken identity. The mistaken identity is because of the false perception. And the false perception is because of the modification that is continually being brought about in the functioning of consciousness. The perceiver modifying the object of perception, because of which we are unable to see what is. In fact, if you turn to that beautiful book of Robert Jones entitled Physics as Metaphor, in that book Physics as Metaphor, the scientist says that ages ago Plato talked about certain men that were tied in the cave, and they were able to look only at the shadows on the wall. They could not turn round and look at the entrance. Such was their condition. They looked at the shadows. They were very greatly fascinated by the shadows. They found shadows very interesting, but they saw only the shadows. And this scientist, this physicist tells us, in his book Physics as Metaphor, he says, we have not moved an inch further from that. You and I, the scientists themselves, we are all in the same position as the men of the clay of the cave of Plato. Those men were looking at shadows. And he says, we are also looking at shadows today. Our shadows have changed. Nevertheless, it is only shadows that we see. We do not know what reality is. We are living only in the world of shadows. This is our condition, because of which we are not able to see that which is. We are unable to comprehend reality. We are unable to comprehend ourselves. In fact, it may seem a very curious statement, but it is true that while we can recognize ourselves, we do not know ourselves. We recognize ourselves. Every day that we look into the mirror, we recognize ourselves. While recognition is there, there is not the knowledge of ourselves. Now, I'm sure you will agree with me that recognition involves a field of continuity. That which belongs to the field of continuity can be recognized. And therefore, when I say I recognize myself, what is it that I am recognizing? I am recognizing that continuing entity with which I have become familiar. And that is why Patanjali in his aphorism says that your consciousness is habit-ridden. You look at everything from habit. Habit is the center of reaction. From that center of reaction, we all the time act, we perceive, we do everything. In other words, everything that we do, including the knowledge that we gather, is because of the reactive activities of the habit. And that is why Patanjali says that yoga means a consciousness that is completely free, free from all centers of habit, not good habit or bad habit, but centers of all habit. That free state of consciousness is what is described as the state of yoga. But the question of questions is, where are we going to go in search of these centers of consciousness? If they have been brought into our consciousness, if our consciousness functions through these centers, which we call the centers of habit, where shall we go in search of these centers of reaction or the centers of habit? Patanjali discusses this exhaustively. Patanjali says there are 5 obstacles on the path of yoga. The first obstacle on the path of yoga is ignorance. Not ignorance in the context of books, whether we have read certain books or we have not read certain books, whether we are familiar with scriptures or we are not familiar with scriptures. That is not ignorance about which Patanjali speaks. He says ignorance of ourselves. We are ignorant about ourselves. And that is the first obstacle which Patanjali puts in his yoga aphorisms. We have absolutely no knowledge of ourselves. We are ignorant of ourselves. And out of this ignorance arises, according to Patanjali, the second obstacle. And the second obstacle is false identification. False identification. Not knowing what I am, not knowing who I am, I have identified myself with what I am not. The word for false identification used by Patanjali in the Sanskrit language is asmita. Asmita means false identification, mistaken identity. We don't know what our identity is, but we have identified with something, identified with that which habit has shown us, identified ourselves with the centers of reaction that have been built in consciousness. This is the second obstacle which Patanjali speaks about in his yoga aphorisms. From this false identification come 2 factors. The 2 factors are attachment and repulsion. Attachment and repulsion arise out of false identification. I am attached to those things which enable me to maintain my identification. I am repulsed by those things which break up or seek to break up this identification. And therefore, in our consciousness, there is this duality that is all the time functioning. The duality of attachment and repulsion. And everything that we do, whatever we experience, whatever we see, is governed and motivated by these pairs of opposites, by these factors of duality which function in our consciousness. And from there, according to Patanjali, arises the 5th obstacle. And the 5th obstacle is described in the Sanskrit language as abhinivesha. which means the desire for continuity. Desire for the continuity of what? Desire for the continuity of false identification. Desire for the continuity of mistaken identity. That is what is going on. I must see that this mistaken identity is not shattered. I don't call it mistaken identity. I know it as myself. I regard it as myself. Who am I? I am this identity. And therefore, I am all the time engaged in guarding this identity. The I, what I call the I must guard this I. I must protect it. Because if that continues, then only I will know what living is. And therefore, I am engaged in seeing that this false identity continues. And this process of the guarding and the protecting of the false identity has become all the more intense in the modern scientific and technological civilization. Because in this vast society, colossal society, which technology has created, in that society, you and I do not count for anything. We have no place, individual place, no creative place. We are just one of the units of life. We are only one of the items of the universe. We have no significance by ourselves. And this loss of significance is becoming more and more as we proceed along the development of scientific and technological society, so that we have lost our sense of significance. In other words, I'm in search of my identity. And the search of identity was never so intense as it is today. It is this which yoga makes it very valid and very relevant today. We need to turn to yoga because yoga enables us to get back our lost identity. Our identity is lost today. We have no identity. We are only units of life, units of society. We can be replaced by other units of society. We have no intrinsic significance at all. And therefore, this struggle to maintain the false identity is all the more serious. It is this which has produced all types of illnesses, all our illnesses. Major part of our illnesses, more than 80% of our illness is because of tensions, stresses and strains. And why is there tension? It is mounting. Out of these tensions and stresses and strains, we are told that even the diseases like cancer come up. But why is there tension? There is the tension because I have lost my identity. I must get back my identity. I have identified myself with the false identity. I must protect it, guard it against everything. This is the cause of tension and strain and stress so far as we are concerned. We are demanding the continuity of that mistaken identity. Because the mistaken identity is something with which I have identified myself. This is what I am. And therefore, I do not want this mistaken identity to go. It must remain. This is the desire for continuity. And therefore, wherever continuity is broken, we are afraid of it. We are all the time eager to maintain this flow of continuity. Dealing with these obstacles in the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, he was a great psychologist. Patanjali speaks about discovering the areas of your habit. Find out where the consciousness has got corrupted. Habit is a blockage of energy. Find out where your energy is blocked. That is what you must do. If you can do that, then you will be able, as Patanjali says, to break this identity and come to the understanding of your true identity. Patanjali says, the first area where energy gets blocked, where this habit formation takes place, where the center of reaction is established, the first area, he says, is examine your logical thinking. He says, in your logical thinking itself, there is habit. It is only by habit that we go on with our logical thinking. In fact, logical thinking has been beautifully analyzed by Patanjali in his Yoga Sutras, where he says, what is your logical thinking? First of all, he says, it is based on sensorial impacts. Secondly, you infer from your sensorial impacts. He says, all your logical thinking is nothing but inference. Scientific knowledge is nothing but inference. But he says there is the third factor. It is true that from sensorial impacts you infer. But what is the conditioning factor of inference? The conditioning factor of inference is your past knowledge. Past knowledge, inference, and sensorial impacts, these are the three factors that Patanjali discusses while talking about logical thinking. And therefore he says, see in the process of logical thinking how you are committed to habits, how you are committed to the memory of the past, how you are committed to the centers of reaction, that all your logical thinking ultimately rests on this factor, the factor of the center of reaction. Then he says that if logical thinking is the producer of this conditioning factor, he says the illogical thinking also produces it. Illogical thinking is an impulsive thinking. In that impulsive thinking, there is very much of the corrupted consciousness that takes part. And therefore, Patanjali says logical thinking, illogical thinking. Then thirdly, he says your fancy, your daydreaming. In your fancy and in your daydreaming also, you will see this factor of continuity, the continuity motivated by the centers of reaction, motivated by habit. And therefore see this daydreaming, this fancy, this wild imagining, because you will find that there is the center of reaction to be found. Then fourthly, he says that the center of reaction is to be found in your sleep. Patanjali, as I said, was a great psychologist. He did not merely think of the conscious mind, he talked of the subconscious mind. He said that in your sleep it is the subconscious mind that functions. And in the functioning of the subconscious mind also, you will find the same position of corruption, of motivation, of the centers of reaction established. And therefore, this is the fourth aspect that he speaks about. He speaks about logical thinking, illogical thinking, fancy or wild imagination. He talks of the sleep. And last but not the least, he says it is memory. And memory, very largely, is the cause of your actions arising from the centers of reaction. He lays great stress on this memory. Remember, memory is not the chronological memory, the historical memory that he speaks about. He describes memory in a beautiful manner. While describing memory, he says, what is memory? He says memory is trying to see that your experience, your pleasant experience, is not stolen away. To see that your pleasant experience is not stolen away, that is memory. If you go into this question of memory, we know that the events pass away. Events can't be held. Events form part of the chronological flow. But along with the event, there is an experience. And while the event passes away, the experience remains unfulfilled. There is a hangover so far as our experience is concerned. And it is on that hangover that memory rests and memory functions through this hangover. And you will thus see beautifully how Patanjali has described not merely the obstacles to yoga, but also he has thrown light as to where modification starts in consciousness. That the centers of modification are in these fivefold regions. And therefore he says, look for that, and then you will be able to see how your consciousness continually gets modified. You will find, if you go into these questions of the flow of consciousness, and the flow of consciousness blocked at one particular place, which we have termed our identification, false identification, where the stream of consciousness has got blocked. Now, what is this blockage? This blockage we can understand in terms of what we, all of us, have done. Namely, we have built our own images. We have built a self-image. Self-image is constructed out of habit. Self-image is constructed out of the centers of reaction. And we, all of us, have created our own self-image. And the self-image is the most obstinate habit that we have. The most obstinate of the corrupting factor of our consciousness, the modifying factor of our consciousness, is this self-image. Just as in the Hindu scriptural texts, there is the Bhagavad Gita, with which I am sure many of you are familiar. There is another Gita also, equally important, a very important scriptural text of the Hindus. And that Gita is known as Ashtavakra Gita, where there is a dialogue between a sage and a king. That is how the Ashtavakra Gita proceeds. Just as the Bhagavad Gita proceeds in the form of dialogue between Sri Krishna the master and Arjuna pupil. But in this other Gita about which I have just now referred, the Ashtavakra Gita, there the sage tells the king, who has gone to the sage with various inquiries, various questions. There is a beautiful verse I am not quoting in Sanskrit because it will not mean anything to most of you. But this particular verse says, the sage tells the king, if you can separate yourself from your image and do what? Then be completely relaxed. You don't have to do anything at all. If you can separate yourself from the image that you have created, then this particular verse says, here and now, you will be happy. Here and now you will be at peace. Here and now you will be liberated. Here and now you don't require the duration of time at all. Here and now you will experience happiness and peace and complete liberation. All that you have to do, this particular verse says, all that you have to do is to separate yourself from the image which you have created. This is the problem of problems, so far as the path of self-realization is concerned. We have to discover this path, because so much has happened by way of modifications and corruptions that we have to discover this path of self-realization so that I know my true identity, not a false identity. And remember, a person who has known, realized his true identity is never afraid of anything. No fear whatsoever. He is completely free from fear. Fear can never touch him, he who has known his true identity. In the Bhagavad Gita, there is the dialogue, as I said, between the master and the pupil. The pupil says, Master, I am not going to fight, I am not going to fight. Then the master says to the pupil, what are you afraid of? Are you afraid of death, killing somebody? Are you afraid of that? Then the Bhagavad Gita says in that context to the pupil, Shri Krishna the master says to the pupil, he says, that which has no existence dies, but that which has true existence never dies. That which has a false existence, it will die. Are you concerned with the false existence? Then it is bound to die. Or are you concerned with the real existence? Then he says, real existence never dies. Life is indestructible. Science tells us that energy cannot be destroyed. Life cannot be destroyed. And therefore, death never touches life at all. Death may touch something that is false, but death does not touch life at all. And that false is what we have called the self-image. What dies is the image. It is bound to die. It is the construct of the mind. It is something which has been put together by the mind. It is a compound. And as Lord Buddha said in one of his sermons, that all compounded things are impermanent. Impermanent are all compounded things. The self-image is a compound. And that which is a compound is bound to be dissolved. But Shri Krishna says to Arjuna, are you weeping for that? Then it is meaningless. Because that which has no real existence, to weep for it is absolutely purposeless. But if you are weeping for something that really exists, then remember it can never die, and therefore all your weeping seems to be false. It is here that this self-image becomes very, very important. We do not realize it. We have not become aware that it is this self-image that is all the time functioning. I want to guard it. This self-image is the image of myself. I am this, I am this, I am this. And I must protect myself because somebody will come and destroy it. The real I cannot be destroyed. It is the false I that can be destroyed. And the false I is the self-image that we have created. To dissolve this self-image, that is indeed to discover the path of self-realization. The path of self-realization can be found only when constantly this image is dissolved. It is true that the mind is going to create more and more images. But once I have known how to dissolve an image, I am not worried about it. Because the mind, by process of thinking, is bound to create images. Every thought creates an image. Every thought creates a form. But see to it that no image becomes so obstinate that it rules over you. By all means, think, and by thinking, create forms. But as the forms are created, you can go on dissolving the forms. And therefore the form, the image, does not stand in the way of the right perception of things. This is the most important point to be considered so far as yoga and self-realization are concerned. It is yoga that enables us to see that the images are destroyed, that the images do not hide the way, the images do not conceal the real identity. The images come and go, but let not the images establish their mastery over our consciousness. This is really the purpose and the function of yoga. How is this to be done? Because one might understand that it is true that we are guided by self-images. We have built up these self-images through centers of reaction, through habits. We have built up these images through repulsions and attachments. And we want this self-image to continue. Because the self-image is myself. It is a false identification that has taken place. But how to be free from this false identification? How can I and you, ordinary people, living our daily lives, engaged in our avocations, is it possible for us to be free from this self-image? Even though it may go for a split second, it may once again come back. But even if it has come for a split second, in that split second, I have seen and I have seen myself what I am. My true nature is perceived. In the writings of one of the very great modern philosophers of India, Sri Aurobindo. Sri Aurobindo, in his monumental book, monumental epic Savitri, says at one place, just one line, he says, "It is the moment that perceives. It is the ages that toil to express. The moment perceives. The perception is only for a moment. The perception is not in time duration. Because time duration is the field in which mind functions. And it is not the mind that can give us the experience of the timeless moment. Mind fragments everything. Mind goes by a dialectical process. The mind functions in the field of duality. The mind must split up every experience in the two dual aspects of the perceiver and the perceived. There must all the time take place this fragmentation of experience, because this is only how mind can know. Mind's knowledge is always a relational knowledge. Mind never knows anything in its absolute aspect. All knowledge is relational knowledge, because it is in relation to something that is opposite. This is the intrinsic drawback so far as the functioning of the mind is concerned, and therefore mind is unable to give us the perception of that ease, because it is caught in the process of time. As you know, time has no independent existence. Time is the creation of the mind, The mind creates time, because it is time that is required for the mind to move. That is the field of the mind. In that field of the mind, there is the movement that goes on, the movement of thought. But we are talking of something where, for a split second, a moment, a timeless moment, if you and I can come to a timeless moment, sometimes, once a day, twice a day, four times a day, once a month, once a year, it does not matter, because quantity is of no value whatsoever. If I have known myself in that timeless moment, then in that timeless moment I have known my true identity. I have realized myself. Self-realization comes only in a timeless moment, not in the duration of time. There is an Upanishad which is known as the Keno Upanishad. In Keno Upanishad, the pupil tells the teacher, he says, "Sir, I am not interested in the how of things, nor am I interested in the why of things. You know, how is the concern of science, why is the concern of philosophy." This young man says, "I am not interested. Why evolution proceeds along this line? How does it proceed?" He says, "I am not interested in this. I am interested in what is it that is doing this? What is it that is moving evolution? If it is nature, what is nature? If it is God, what is God? If it is life, what is life? I am interested in this what and nothing else." In fact, this is the question which modern physics is saying. Modern physicists tell us that we have seen more than 100 dances of the particles. But who is the dancer? We do not know who the dancer is. This was the question that was raised in Keno Upanishad. Who is doing this? Who is moving all this? As the discussion proceeds in that Upanishad, as you come to the close of the Upanishad, after the fascinating dialogue between the teacher and the pupil, the teacher says, "You want to know what it is? Then let me tell you, that which is, that reality, that supreme identity, that is something which can be known in the flash of lightning. It can be known only in the twinkling of an eye." Flash of lightning, or twinkling of an eye, not in time duration, but where time has come to a stop even for a moment, then that moment is the most revolutionary moment. Because in that moment and there alone, self-realization is possible. Self-realization is not the product of time. It is where time comes to a stop. We must understand that the flow of thought and the flow of time are identical. The flow of thought and the flow of time are identical. When the flow of thought is slow, then the time seems long. When the flow of thought is fast, then the time seems very short. This is our experience. If you are listening to a difficult lecture, some difficult point, the flow of thought is becoming slow, and therefore you have to look again and again to your watches. When will this 1 hour be over? But when the flow of thought is fast, then the time flies. If that is the case, and that is the case, then it is possible for you and for me to control this time, to be a master of this time, not to be a slave of this time, but time is in my hands. I can slow down the flow of thought. And if I can slow down the flow of thought, then to that extent, I have become the master of that thought process. If it is only in the twinkling of an eye, if it is only in the timeless moment that reality can be perceived, if only in the timeless moment there can be self-realization, then we must deal with this problem of time. And the problem of time is the problem of the flow of thought. If I can see that the flow of thought slows down, or if it comes to a total cessation, when the flow of thought comes to a total cessation, then that is that moment in which the right perception is possible. In that moment, there is the possibility of self-realization. Nowhere else it must come. But the question of questions is, how to bring about this quietening of the flow of thought? How to see that the flow of thought ceases? even though it may be for a split second. How to do it? Is it possible for us to do it? Can we consciously do it? I suggest we can consciously do it. And the conscious working on this flow of time, and therefore the flow of thought, is indicated in another great book of yoga, which is the Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavad Gita is a book of yoga. In fact, every chapter of the Bhagavad Gita ends with the statement that this chapter is included in the science of yoga. The Bhagavad Gita is a science of yoga. The simplest exposition of the science of yoga you find in the Bhagavad Gita. And in this Bhagavad Gita, the master deals with the question of the pupil. The pupil says, "Sir, my mind is restless. It never gives me any relaxation. It goes on and on and on. It is a restless mind. Unless you tell me how to bring this mind to a rest, even though it may be a temporary rest, if you can tell me about that, then I shall be able to understand the implications of your philosophy. Otherwise, your philosophy has no meaning for me, because my mind is restless. I cannot control this mind. I cannot bring this mind to a restful condition. And so please show me the way." And the way is shown in the Bhagavad Gita. That is the way which brings us to the vision of our true self, to our true identity. We come to self-realization by this process. What is that process? The Bhagavad Gita says, and you will find this particular idea given throughout the Hindu scriptures and throughout the Buddhist scriptures, you will find. You will find in both these religious scriptures the same process indicated to us. And the process is, watch your mind. Watch your mind, observe your mind. To observe the mind means to observe the thought process, to observe the procession of thought that emerges out of the mind. And the Bhagavad Gita says this, the other scriptures also say, the Buddhist scriptures say, just observe this procession of thought. But that is exactly our difficulty. We can't observe. Try to observe. The moment you try to observe, the mind will say, "I am not open, I'm pulling down my shutters. My shop is closed." And therefore you will find that when you try to observe, there is nothing to observe. Why? What is it that we have to observe? What is it that disturbs us when we are in moments of reflection or in moments of meditation? That which disturbs us is the distractions that have been thrown up by our subconscious mind. In our subconscious mind, we have put everything that I can't bring up, because I must maintain my image. I am a respectable person. And therefore, I must not allow these ugly things to come up. They may come up in my dream, but they are not going to come up in my waking state. And so we have pushed everything into the subconscious. And the more we push, the more vital the subconscious becomes. The subconscious has tremendous energy. And it is that subconscious which is obstructing us in our moments of quiet, in our moments of silence, in our moments of reflection. It is the subconscious that is all the time disturbing us. And therefore, the act of observation has to be first. The conscious mind observing what comes from the subconscious. It can be done. Because you might say, who is going to observe? The conscious mind is going to observe. We are not talking of any abstractions, of any philosophical speculation. The conscious mind can observe, if it wants to observe, what comes up from the subconscious. Not all at once. It's not possible to do it all at once. But gradually you can see. You will, first of all, be able to see in your dreams. If you study your dreams, that which comes constantly in the dream, take it that that which comes, that which is a recurring thing in the dream, is something through which the subconscious wants to speak. Because straightway the subconscious cannot speak. We are going to suppress it. And therefore the subconscious uses subterfuges. It comes through dreams. It comes through certain impulsive moments. It is during those moments that the subconscious comes. Try to look at it. Try to look at it at neutral levels. Don't try this observation at levels which are very, very difficult. not at psychologically involved areas, but in neutral areas. Just begin to see what is it that the mind brings up. Remember, there are two things which have to be observed so far as mind is concerned. The behavior of the thought pattern, in other words, the thought pattern, the thought structure, and secondly, the motivations of the thought structure. It is not enough that I notice the structure of thought. That you can do if you are given to review and you say, yes, I'm going to review from morning to night. And you can probably recapture the whole structure of thought during the day. That is certainly necessary, but that by itself will not help. You have to also observe the motivations of the subconscious impulses. If the conscious mind can do this, and remember, the story of the subconscious is an untold story. Nobody has listened to it. When it comes up, it is a distraction. But when I resist it, the distraction becomes a disturbance. To be distracted and yet not to be disturbed is really the secret of concentration. Distractions are bound to come. But when do distractions become disturbance? When I resist this distraction. If you don't resist it, you will find that it is possible for you to observe it. This can be done as you drive a motor car. You drive a motor car, your attention is at the focal level. But you are not just concentrated on what is in front. You are also aware, although dimly aware, of what is going on both the sides. While driving the car, while your attention riveted at the focal level, still at the same time, you are aware of what is happening on the margin. And the moment you say, no, I don't want to see the margin, then what will happen? Then you will break down in your motor driving. You are able to drive your car with relaxation because you are able to be aware of the margin. Now, this is exactly the secret of extensive awareness which we have to experiment about. This is extensive awareness. And in this extensive awareness, something strange happens. What is it that happens? There is a friendly relationship established between the focal and the marginal. There is a friendly relationship that is established between the conscious and the subconscious. And the moment a friendly relationship is established, then you can ask the subconscious to reveal itself. It will reveal many, many things. Go on looking at it, because you are now on friendly terms, and the subconscious is in a position to reveal itself. Just see what the subconscious has to say. With regard to any particular topic regarding which you found that it is distracting you, just ask the subconscious. Start a dialogue with the subconscious. And if you start the dialogue with the subconscious, you will find that the subconscious reveals itself. In fact, if you ask me to define concentration, concentration is the awareness of distractions. And meditation is the dialogue with distractions. Dialogue with distraction. Now the subconscious is willing to talk, and you will find that as the subconscious reveals itself, it tells you all that it has contained so far with regard to that particular subject. In telling its story, the subconscious will become quiet. It will become quiet. You have not enforced silence on it. It has become quiet because you have listened to its story. And because you have listened to its story, it has told the story about that particular topic. Having done this, it has become quiet. Remember, this is the first stage of silence. It is in silence and silence alone that self-realization is possible. But this is only the first stage of silence. The conscious mind having a dialogue with the subconscious. The subconscious which has become friendly and therefore is in a position to talk. When you have come to that, then you move to the second stage of silence. And the second stage of silence is where the chatterings of the conscious mind themselves have ceased. Not the chattering of the subconscious that has come to silence. But the conscious mind also chatters. The conscious mind also modifies, corrupts, brings about all sorts of difficulties. And so it is not enough that the subconscious has become silent. The conscious mind also must become silent. But how will the conscious mind become silent? How can you observe the conscious mind? You can observe the subconscious because the conscious observes the subconscious. But who is going to observe the conscious mind so that the conscious mind may come to silence? Here the conscious mind observes itself. You may say this is ridiculous. How can the conscious mind observe itself? Just as you and I have never seen our faces directly. We recognize ourselves, but we have never seen our faces directly. And yet we know, because we have looked at our faces in the mirror. This is exactly what the conscious mind can do. The conscious mind can observe itself in the mirror of human relationships. It can observe itself in daily avocations, because the mind is all the time reflected. How you speak, how you sit, how you talk, what you read, how you read, all these factors, even the smallest of the factor, in that the mind is reflected. If the conscious mind can look itself in the mirror of human relationship, in the mirror of life, then in the very observation of itself, it becomes quiet. Because there is a great mystery about self-image. When is self-image dissolved? The exposure itself dissolves the self-image. In the very act of exposure, when the self-image is exposed, when the conscious mind is exposed to itself, then in that exposure and there alone, the self-image goes and the conscious mind has come to a silence. Where there is the quiet of the subconscious and where there is the silence of the conscious mind, that is the moment where time has ceased. Because the mind has come to silence. The silence of the mind is the cessation of time. It is the cessation of the flow of thought. And if the flow of thought is identical with the flow of time, then in that quiet and in that silence, the flow of thought has ceased. The time has ceased. And you see there, for the first time, in the cessation of time and in the cessation of thought, you see for the first time, reality as it is, not corrupted, not modified, not impinged upon by motivations. But you see it, in the moment you see it. This is the moment of self-realization. It happens in the twinkling of an eye. It happens in the flash of lightning. The flash of lightning is not in time, where time has stopped. And therefore it is possible for you and for me to come to the experience of the cessation of time, which means the cessation of thought. This is what yoga indicates. This path that the Bhagavad Gita has indicated is the path of yoga. Observe yourself, observe your thought, observe your mind. In Buddhism, the Buddha said once that it is the fourfold observation that alone is enough. You don't have to do anything at all. He said the observation of the bodily movements, the observation of breathing, the observation of thought, and the observation of your motivations. This fourfold observation about which the Buddha spoke. And here in the Bhagavad Gita, observe the thought in action, observe the mind in action. That is indicated. This is the path of self-realization. The path of self-realization is the silence of the mind. And it is this which is related to yoga, because yoga is fundamentally this action, where the mind, for the time being, has come to a moment of silence. The experience of the silence of the mind is the experience of yoga. And it is the experience of the silence of the mind which is the experience of self-realization. This is yoga, and this is the path of self-realization. Thank you very much.